All conversations and information exchanged during participation in this podcast or interaction on the DrDrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or physician medical advice or direction per se. You must always follow your medical professional's advice and direction. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Please understand, I am not playing the role of physician in this environment per se. I'm educating. I am a licensed physician with specialty boards in American Board of Internal Medicine and American Board of Addiction Medicine. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around that Galaxy Android device of yours and get ready for another episode of This Life with Bob and Drew.
Now you're excluding the iPhone.
Yeah, no, I'm getting away from the iPhone. I'm not, you know.
It's funny because I checked this out before I drove up here, and I saw of you guys watching something or doing something, and I could see Drew in the distance watching TV.
Yeah, football.
And I'm like, oh, okay.
Are you ready for football?
We've never done that. We'll introduce the guest. And I'll tell you, I've never done this before. It's because of the playoff and the Super Bowl.
This is my buddy. This is my pal, Ashley Hamilton. The only person, only one of two people, bless you, Drew.
Excuse me.
One of only two people that have been to more rehabs than myself.
Really?
This
impressive.
Gentleman right
no,
here.
I think Robert Downey Jr. has a record. That's 45.
Who was the
45?
Other one? Oh, really? Robert was in 45?
I don't know.
You're in 35?
32.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Martine, 35.
Who was number 35?
Is he beat? No.
Who was? Who was number one?
Robert Downey, man.
Robert's like 45, I think.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And people see that as insanity. I say, we know it's a solution. It just isn't working. We're trying again.
It's so
I see it as a hopeful thing, not this negative thing that everybody says.
Yeah, but
right?
It's so great to quit drugs up until it's time to quit drugs. Like Rehab was like the greatest idea, you know, and then you dealt with this,
while
right?
You're using,
and both of you guys,
while
all
you're
people,
using quitting is a good idea.
Yeah, it has to build on itself, and it has to come from a certain place. It has to come from you.
Yeah.
Right? And it's hard, man.
It's so hard.
It is hard.
It's so hard. I was the thing, like, always I remember being in Exodus. They're like, sir, you've been here 13 times. And I'm like, did I get a punch card or anything at this point? Like, and I'd always come up with ways to bring stuff in, you know, like the Speedball and the Cinnabon, because they started hipping on me.
Cinnabon.
Yeah, in the Cinnabon. Remember? You put it in the Cinnabon, and then they can't find it. Now you're going to, like, bust somebody with it. Or burritos. That's a wild
McDonald's hamburgers.
Yeah, put it in the thing for
balloons in the hamburgers.
No, it's already drawn up, because they're quick to check, so you got to do it. And I years later, I saw a guy named, do you know Dr. Kartaya? It's a doctor.
No.
He's like, you don't remember me, do you? And I'm like, no. I'm sorry. He goes, I saved your life. I go, you did. Should I thank you or no? but he goes, you OD'd, flatlined in Exodus in the shower. Oh. And I had to revive you because it was, you know, I had the hospital room right there and stuff. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't stop. It's so hard. And you deal with that too.
Very few people stop and go, man, that is hard. If you just make note of it and support you on that basis, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and when you're in it, you may not care.
You don't.
Really, you're just like, let's go.
And that's what's so scary, because I'm sure you relate to this, Bob. Like, people will be like, oh, you're going to die. And you're like, promise?
Like, really?
That's where it takes you. It takes me that way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people would say, well, he's so fortunate. You know, I've heard quotes about you before we became close, right? He's so handsome. He's so talented. He comes from this family. Da, da, da. What the fuck's wrong with him? You had that from AA members coming at you.
Yeah, I promise you never feel that way. So it's, you
right?
know.
Like, that's what, Drew, get that. He never felt that way.
Ever.
No, right?
How could an addict possibly feel lucky?
I wrote a song one time called Hurt about feeling so ugly and awful and unlovable,
so Trent,
right?
Trent covered that from you?
No, different kind. But one of the handsomest, most successful people in the world said that song spoke to him. That's how he feels. And I was like, no. That's fucked up. Yeah. That song is not for people like you.
Yeah, but does
you
isn't,
I mean?
isn't it a monument to how we are as human beings?
It's
right?
weird.
No matter what we got, we all feel some sense of inadequacy. Not everybody, but from my point of view, interesting people feel inadequate, feel unlovable, feel whatever. They have some sort of something in them.
And that's, you know, that's the human experience. You know, when something goes a little off track when we're kids and we carry it around the rest of our lives.
I think forever.
No matter what
I'm
going to
show them.
I think that's what fuels relapse, a lot of it, is not feeling worthy, not feeling whole, mm-hmm. not feeling lovable or loved
but
or inability
becomes,
to feel.
But I want to, again, caution everyone against thinking that somehow fixing that would fix addiction. You got to fix the addiction first, then you can start to work on that stuff. Now, what would you – you in the past, you and I have talked about how that's – you think that may be, in a lot of cases, an attachment injury.
Well, I think that – but it reinforces and gets worse over time.
Is it an attachment injury or something else, or is it a multiplicity of things? And try to explain to people what you mean by an attachment injury.
Because if somebody tells me they love me, immediately, if I come from a traumatized background, I'm suspicious of that. Mm-hmm. What do they want? What the fuck does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm defensive against allowing people to appreciate me, love me, be intimate
with me. Right. So they can't even enter a frame with you
right.
to be close to you.
Right. Okay. Then when they do and when it happens, and it happened many times before I got sober, I would sabotage it.
Sure.
Right?
Okay.
And that's, I think, what... You know, the people that worked at Exodus, where you and I, you went 13 times, I went 8 times. I love them still to this day. I still talk to Harold Owens every
that.
Other week. Mm. Lori, who worked there, mm-hmm. right? Kathy Kilgar, the
Keith.
Nurse.
Yeah.
Unbelievable mm-hmm. people who
yeah.
I admired
Jeff
and
Kramer.
I knew they cared about me.
Yeah.
But as soon as I could figure out a way to,
but that's,
to
that's separate
sabotage
now,
it.
But that's now your addiction using your proclivities, right?
Okay, so how does it do that? Because addicts don't understand.
Okay,
that.
So you have this, whatever this difficulty.
Here's how it happens. They say, Bob, we want you to stay an outpatient another month. I'm like, oh, fucking no way.
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
What they were really saying is, let us love you another month. Uh-huh. Be a part of this. It's fun. And I would have had fun that whole month. Right? You go through the suffering for a month inpatient, then you're an outpatient, and they want you to stay longer. You're like, oh, no.
Okay, so you have this thing in your head that's saying use or else. So it's got all your usual priorities.
But you don't think that.
You don't know it because it's a motivational state. It's not a conscious state. It's a motivational push, which is use. And anything that gets in the way of that is suspect. And if you have some psychological issue that also motivates you against going forward, like it's painful to get close to people, they might abandon me, your disease is going to go, yeah, that's right, get the fuck out of here. You see?
Right.
So now you have two motivations. You have a do-it-again motivation, and you have an avoidant motivation, both working on you. Now, if you got rid of the avoidant one, you'd still have that do-it-again thing going there.
And that happens in so many relationships, too, with
yep.
like women and all that
yep.
stuff. You
yep.
know, like it's the same thing. It's just you get to a place where you just freeze up and want to run at a certain point. You know, like –
But you got to – how long? What's your longest period of sobriety?
Five.
5 years.
Yeah.
And did you have a close relationship during like
– I did for four of it, yeah.
Okay. So probably did better then.
I did.
Yeah. So you got to get the sobriety first, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can sort of start to creep into being close to somebody.
But I'm sure you relate to this too, Bob. Like, that's so crazy. It's like no matter what you achieved or what you tried to get, like I remember, so the first number one song I wrote was for a guy named Robbie Williams. It was
right.
like a song called Come Undone. It's first smash. All I wanted to do was have one hit. I was like, if I could just have that,
everything would be good.
Yeah. And you believe that, right? Like,
yeah.
I believe it still to this
and
day.
That's what's so insane. I was just going to say that. Like, I still like, no, but this time, guys, this
yeah.
time.
Now you're sober. Now it's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, but I remember.
I don't think Robbie Williams is going to have it, but somebody
no, but it was good. It started a good place to go, but I know what you mean. And I was writing for Liam Gallagher at the same time, too, so that whole dichotomy was very interesting,
oh,
too,
because wow.
they hated each other, and there were such different
I'm
worlds.
Sure.
And I was just saying that to somebody today. I sent it to my girlfriend today. I was like, you can't. Like, that's the thing about writing songs. If you, as an artist, you can fit in anywhere, and you just feel like, because you don't really know who you are, you know? And that works great as, like, a songwriter. As an artist, it's very hard because you can just jump in and become that, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is the chameleon thing, which is not so great.
Not
it comes
good.
From
not
issues.
Good. Yeah.
Not
going to
have any.
Not good.
Jew.
No issues. But it does remind me of something that I've found to be true of everybody I've found who has a public life that didn't first have some other job other than their work in the public, they don't use their real name. They always use some pseudonym, some sort of nickname or something. Always. You notice
yeah.
that, Bob?
Well, some do. But
my real name is more manly. It's Stacy Hamilton. So.
Is it really?
No.
That's funny.
Yeah. Let's talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up? Beverly Hills, I assume.
Yeah, I grew up in Beverly Hills, Santa Monica.
You go to Beverly Hills High School or Crossroads or Brentwood Academy? Where'd you go?
Okay, I'm trying to remember it all.
These are all those schools where all drug addicts come from, Drew. The best schools in Los Angeles.
I went to Elroy. My mom married Rod, right, when I was 3 or 4, I guess.
What was that like? Freaky?
We'll get there. Do you got any Valium so I can talk about it?
We don't want to trigger you.
No, it's fine.
And then they had a child right away, did they not?
They did.
How'd that go for you at 5?
It was all right. I mean, it was different.
Did you like having a little brother?
I don't know. I'm not sure. It was a sister first.
Oh, sister.
But I'm not sure. But
I thought you and Sean are about the same age. How much younger is he?
Six years younger than me.
You know who was a friend of mine in high school was Tony Peck.
Oh, yeah, of
they
course.
They live right next door to you guys.
Right next door.
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
I know. That's great about the areas. You don't know who your neighbor. You might know who your neighbors are, but you never have one conversation with them. Because everybody's just in gates. You know, like we don't want any walls, but everybody has big walls around everybody. Like, it's so crazy.
Oh, the liberals don't want walls except for around their estates in Beverly Hills.
Which are massive.
Which are too much, anyways.
Gregory Peck's son was
he's been doing great forever though,
really good,
yeah,
and
so he was an addict as well.
Oh yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it's fascinating because so I grew up there, and then my dad at 12 is like, kid, my real dad. He's like, you got. I'm like,
your real dad, who George. Every time I see your George, eyes, yeah. I think, well, yeah. I don't know a lot, but I know he played Evel Knievel.
Yeah,
that's all. He like every time I see him on a commercial or something, yeah. I'm like. I try to explain who Evel Knievel is,
yeah,
and that your dad played him
in
the movie. It was just, I was like, how old when that came out? What year did that come out?
It was late 70s, right?
Yeah, I was like 17 or something.
How many
like,
times was he like, on the Johnny Carson show?
I don't know.
Hundreds.
I swear to God. He was
hundreds.
All the time.
Really?
Drew's like the George Hamilton of podcasts.
for sure. He's a great storyteller, though.
He is. I've spoken to your dad before. Yeah.
But yeah, how did he convince Evel Knievel to let him play him? Because Evel Knievel wasn't the easiest guy to deal with.
My dad's a great hustler, I got to tell you.
Is
he? He's got the gift of gab, man.
You're talking about Evel Knievel, Drew, at that time was the biggest rock star. There was Muhammad Ali, Evel Knievel. George Hamilton convinces Evel Knievel, who's about the same age as him, to let him play him in his biopic.
Yeah. And then he gets John Milius, who wrote Apocalypse Now, to write it.
Holy
but, like,
shit.
He didn't know how. He's like, I don't think so. And finally, John Milius goes to my dad, okay, George, I want guns, gold, and women. And he's like, my dad's like, I can do that for you. So he just gave him a ton of drugs, put him up in Palm Springs in his house, and they stayed there real evil. Oh my God.
Have you ever seen it, Drew?
Never saw
Lauren
it.
Lauren Bacall plays the...
Because I
wife, right?
I think I was aware.
Reporter. Yeah, the reporter.
I think I was sort of aware of what Evel Knievel actually was as a human being.
Oh yeah,
and I didn't dig it.
Oh yeah, my dad said he was a scary dude.
Yeah, scary alcoholic.
I want to know what it was like living with Rod Stewart. Okay,
back to Rod Stewart.
Oh my God,
his hair mousse babysitted me once. That's all I can say.
Right?
No. It was cool. I mean, you know, people ask that, but you just don't know difference, really. You know, like what's it like to grow up and you just don't know anything different as a kid, I feel like, you know.
So did the musical side come from
that part was awesome because they would rehearse in the garage there all the time.
Remember the bass player, Chinese guy?
Chin. Well, there was Carmine.
No, the bass player I bought.
There was Jim.
I bought his amp.
I don't remember.
They had white amps. They had like Ampegs put with white.
I think that was later.
That was 70s.
Was that 70s?
Right.
Yeah. I don't. I can't help you out with that, Bob.
But
sorry.
Chen, his name was. He was a really good bass player.
It. Yeah.
But so you grew up around music, then you know that songwriting is the most important part of music.
Correct.
That you were taught at a very early age, and I think a lot of musicians' children know that because what is it Rod Stewart thinking about? What is Liam Gallagher thinking about? What is everybody who makes music thinking about all the time? Writing songs.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say drugs.
Well, drugs.
When they're not thinking about drugs.
Well, you have to have something to motivate the writing of drugs. Yeah. I mean the writing of songs.
Yeah, and so you learn that environment. I always had so many nerves. I hated being in front of people. I hated like playing. It made me so uncomfortable. I would shake and like I had spastic colon and they had me on phenobarbital.
Oh my God, early
13. Yeah, early.
Shit, that made where this all kicked in.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
I mean, you got to understand something. When they expose your nervous system to those kinds of drugs early, it amplifies the effect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And some people just don't have that, you know, and I had it. I hated doing live stuff, you know, writing, no problem. But like the artist stuff, I just didn't enjoy it. You know, I felt really super uncomfortable. It's terrible.
Well, what you know, teenager can get up in front of people and perform? That's hard.
Well, he eventually did. He got over his stage fright with heroin and cocaine.
Then I was just paranoid on stage. Yeah.
It's
like, oh, you hate me? Don't worry. I hate me too. It's just going to go down fine tonight.
No, we got mutual love. Mutual love.
Hey, Susan has the bass player. Tetsu Yamauchi.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Wow. That was a bass player.
What year was that?
I don't know. Nick, go.
Oh, wow. That was before my time. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But he had a white amp. It was on sale at Guitar Center.
And we grew up, a lot on the. Oh, was at the Guitar Center. I thought you guys were friends.
No, Bonner. Okay. Thelonious Monster.
I thought you got it from him.
Bonner
sounded like he knew the guy so well.
No, I knew.
The Guitar Center. Okay.
I was at Guitar Center, and that stuff was for sale. And I was like, that's the guy from Rod Stewart's band. We got to buy that.
Like, I got that guitar from Slash at the Guitar Center.
But it's true.
But I grew up a lot on the road, too. So I didn't know, like, just traveling a lot, you know, so tutored and traveling.
But you wanted to do it, obviously, from a young age. You wanted to be a musician.
Were you pushed into it?
No, I loved music, you know. And then my dad at 12 was like, you got to get out of here, man. I'm like, I know, I got to get out of here, too, at 12. I was like, I got to get out of this town. At 12 years old, like, that's how crazy I knew it was.
And your dad says you got to get out of... Yeah. Oh my God!
Went to boarding school.
Mean streets of
Switzerland.
Hills.
Where'd you go?
Oh my God!
No, I went to military school.
Military school. That's a good one.
Yeah. Where?
Lebanon, Tennessee. Castle Heights.
What was that experience like?
Castle Heights Military Academy. I tell you what.
A little different than Rod Stewart's house in Beverly Hills.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
Wow.
More guys.
Were you already smoking weed?
Did they know you were doing drugs?
No, nothing. None of that. I wasn't doing drugs or anything.
George pushed this, or
but I wanted to go too. My friend Auburn Grant was going to military school. It sounded like a great idea. It's like the early alcoholic thing where you're like, the fantasy of it sounds so great, and then you get there and like, drop down and give me 10, 20. Right. I mean, give me 10, fatty, because I was really fat. So I said 10, 20. I don't know what I'm saying. But I was really heavy at that point. So, So I wanted to go. And to answer your question, it was great because you start to learn for the first time that you have to all depend on each other. Uh-huh. And the structure and the environment of everybody together like that and the camaraderie is really like, it's good.
Why'd you hate rehab so much? It's the same thing.
Exactly.
It was no drugs. Exactly. No drugs.
Wasn't enough like that. That's the problem.
Exactly. No. And then you become an addict. Then you fight all that stuff, right? Like the one thing we need, that structure and discipline and stuff.
Well, Dr. Blum, who we worked with for years, that was Drew's partner, went to boarding school as a kid.
Did he? I didn't know that.
And he said the first thing he learned when he got into boarding school at earlier than 12, I think, was they'd play chess. And then whoever lost had to take shots out of the chess pieces. They were all filled with booze. That's what you learned at boarding school.
I think you drank each piece as you got knocked off.
Yeah.
Well, I got kicked out that following year, so I went to those kind of schools. But military school wasn't like that yet. Yeah.
And then you come back to Hollywood, what, at 16?
No, 15.
When did you
14?
Start your first band? Is then, right?
14. I got signed to Atlantic at 14.
Oof. Okay.
Yeah.
That is not.
So, what's the difference between military school and just boarding Exodus. School? You learn how to shoot a gun or.
No,
drugs. Access to drugs and girls.
Uniforms in military school, too, right? Yeah. Uniforms and drills. Like, really,
you learned how to shoot a gun or just a lot of.
Kind of, but they were careful with that stuff because of liability and stuff. But it was run all by military.
Oh,
and
so, okay.
I mean, if you did ROTC, you could. Then you do that and you go out and you do all the jumping.
Was there a movie with Timothy Hutton and all those guys about a military school and Sean Penn was in it?
Oh, Taps.
Taps.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah.
Was that your experience?
No.
You didn't take over the school?
No, I was too much of a pussy to do that. They paddle you there. It would hurt.
Paddle
I was like,
you.
Yeah, I'm definitely not taking over a school if they paddle you. Yeah, I was like... Not about it. Not
do
about
they
it.
Get a lot of like kids that are
troubled?
Juvenile delinquents?
I don't
like that,
know.
Or is it just more rich kids with
I don't know.
Parenting problems.
It's a mix.
But you're so it's so regimented. How do you say the word?
Regimented.
Thank you. I knew that. Don't mock me. You say that like you know your sergeant you know first private first class all that stuff. So there's you know
hierarchy.
Young
males respond to hierarchies like crazy.
Yeah,
we really respond to them.
Yeah.
So then you come back. I had always heard you had your first band when you were 16, so you're 14, but you didn't really have a band. It was just you, right? And then you had to be in a band, make a band.
Yeah, they do all that. Yeah, I had some people I worked with, at that point.
And that's when
We had pink guitars and stuff and long hair. Was that it? Thank 80s. God there's no videos of that. Now, now it's horrible because Google just ruined your dating life because they can look back 30 years. I'm glad they couldn't look back 40 years. So then, even worse.
I used to run into your dad backstage at concerts.
Which one?
Like K-Rock concerts and stuff. Oh, he was always there.
Rod?
No, not your dad, but Rod Stewart.
Oh, yeah. Kimberly and Sean, all those guys go to that stuff. But right. it's. I mean, you know, growing up in that kind of stuff, I guess it's just – you don't know any difference, but you learn real quick that people want stuff. And that's
from
where
you.
Yes, and there's where your lack of trust starts. Mm. You start to find that out real early.
You know,
on.
I was thinking about it as you were talking. I remember Tony being that way too.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that whole just going up into that neighborhood was
yeah,
weird for
hills.
Me. It was
yeah.
very like, whoa. I no wonder people feel uncomfortable. You know,
yeah.
Like you go into their kitchen and the kitchenette, here's, you know, Fred Astaire sitting there,
yeah.
crotchety old Fred talking to Gregory Peck, and you know, they're like, "Jeez, this is a whole parallel universe," and that people want access to.
I don't
want to
know that Fred Astaire was crotchety. He's happy.
Was
he's
he
always
not?
Dancing.
I don't
you guys
remember.
Know
I don't know.
He's in
well,
your neighborhood,
he's old,
he was old and crotchety. Trust me. So, but it was such a. It was like uncomfortable, like walking on eggshells, and it didn't feel. Easy. It didn't feel natural. It didn't feel comfortable for
yeah.
me. And I wonder if
I didn't feel like it. I felt like I grew up in a museum, you know, because the lamps were like $30,000. You couldn't touch this. You couldn't
yeah.
go there.
Right.
You couldn't like. It was so bizarre that part of that.
And where
like,
was your dad live in the same neighborhood?
Yeah, he
Did
was.
Did you go over to his house a lot?
You know, at that point, him and my mom weren't friends. Like now, they're the best of friends, but they weren't. They weren't really talking then. So I would see him. You know, he was away working a lot, so I'd see him when I could see him. You know,
okay.
So at that time, it was mainly Rod. And,
but was he in that hood too? Was he up in that?
Yeah,
area?
To Ben Rod.
He was.
There.
I think he was in Beverly Hills. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's funny is you guys are recalling
okay,
something.
Dude.
Well, but. One of my closest friends growing up was Gene Kelly's son, Tim.
Yeah.
And we'd go over there and Gene would drink and he'd do Singing in the Rain. And it was just the funnest house in the world.
But, you know,
that was below Sunset.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Not,
yeah, we don't. Yeah. We weren't allowed to go bad neighborhoods like south of Sunset. You think I'm kidding, too? They wouldn't let us ride south of Sunset on our bike.
What was Gene Kelly doing south of Sunset?
Yeah, well,
with
bad,
you.
Bad investments,
oh,
probably. I don't
but
know.
I figured out, because like, you have that dope fiend mentality as a kid. I think it's in you if you have that addict mentality. That,
yeah.
So already I was like hustling. So like at 8, I was selling, you know, autographs of Rod Stewart through the gate. And
see, that's weird.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't blame you. That's the world. You were in this fishbowl, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like a weird fishbowl.
Makes
bowl
them
thing.
Dough.
I was making money for my G.I. Joe.
Were they laughing? Would Rod know about it?
No, hell no. They just have a stack in the kitchen. I knew
that's
how to forge
so cool.
the signature.
You
they're already signed to the bottom, so you just had to say the name.
And, you know, on one hand, you go, hey, industrious. What a cool thing the kid does.
No,
but,
I used
but
to
it was,
do that, too.
Yeah.
You used to do that?
I used to sell loaves of bread to the neighbors.
Yeah, but if your dad was...
That's a little nicer. That's different. That's because you care, maybe. You're concerned you want them to eat.
Take my mom's bread. Go next door and say my mom.
Take their money
with
fake autographs.
Yeah, different neighborhoods, different things. But... So you're about the same age as the Menendez brothers, right?
No,
they're south of
they're,
Sunset.
They're, exactly.
They're south of Sunset.
South.
That's why you
That's
weren't allowed
to
go
to
down
me.
There?
No, I
You're about the same age. The
no,
same,
no, they're what? Older than me.
Are they?
Yeah, because they were already like seniors when that went down, you know?
Oh, okay. Because the newest thing, Drew, and I've already bought it on eBay. It's been spotted by Slam Magazine. That the Mark Jackson 1989 basketball card, the point guard for the New York Knicks, who's now a television analyst,
mm-hmm.
sitting in the front row, equal size to Mark Jackson,
oh, yeah,
are the
this.
Menendez
yeah,
brothers.
I saw that.
You saw it?
Yeah, I saw it.
I bought it on eBay. It's coming to my house.
Wow.
It'll be here Monday or Tuesday.
Oh,
so, Drew, you're probably wondering why we've gathered this meeting for you.
Yes,
it's to do with your football addiction.
I know.
Yeah.
We're concerned.
My wife put the damn thing on. Turn it off.
It's going cool, man.
Poor Ashley catches me.
I like
it.
The more you ignore me, the more I like you.
No, it's good. It's actually interesting.
You know what I'm talking about, Bob.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
We're addicted to football. So
yeah.
But so that neighborhood.
But it
then,
is a close game.
Then, but then by, I'm trying to think of what year I met you. So Martijn was playing bass with you when? What year is that?
You know, it's so crazy. I just had
Victor and Martijn.
Let me get back to that really quick. I had a vision of us. We did The Love Line when it was a TV show. I remember.
Oh, were you on the TV show?
Yeah, but I remember the radio we did a bunch of times. And I remember I was breaking up with this girl. And I remember he said to me, "This." I still tell people this today. He's like, don't contact her. Because every time you contact her, it's like going to the dope man's house. You got to start all over again. And I always remember that.
That's what I've been saying about Pete Davidson for his whole mess. You know, it's like, stay away. Stay away. Forget it.
Like every breakup after are people. It's so true. You like, it's like taking a hit again. It starts all over.
100%. You can maybe go back after 6 months. Maybe.
It's
but
so
even
true.
Then, it's like a little bit of a chip. You're still chipping.
It's so true.
Speaking of chip, I got to take a break. Be right back.
Oh, my God.
Well, CBDs are everywhere, right? Everyone's talking about them, and it's a topic that I get asked about all the time. Bottom line on CBD, although there are way more claims made about them, the clinical evidence right now, it's not all that clear, but many people are using it and reporting great results, and they are very encouraging. So I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD is cannabidiol, an extract from hemp. While you might associate with marijuana, CBD does not cause reinforcement. It is not the reinforcing component of hemp, but it is what's responsible for the calming or some of the relaxing effects that many people experience, not the high. Now about the products. There are a ton of them on the market today. Forgetting the vast array of the reported health benefits, it's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not the hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is described to you so you can make an informed decision without all those promises that are probably too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD by individuals using this are very compelling. I'm excited to see how things develop as the science catches up with this booming industry. As usual, the public is ahead of the science. I can't make explicit claims yet, but boy, the reports are pretty encouraging. So if you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That's on my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. And for a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with the code DRDREW, DRDREW. Again, drdrew.com/select, and then the code DRDREW.
Are we back on?
Yeah, we're back on. Okay. Drew, we're back. Drew.
He wants to watch this kick. Hold on.
Wait, let's see. Okay.
We're back. We're back.
Yeah, this is a different kind of kick. Don't worry, people.
Oh, my God. We're back. But so probably, what is it, 90, 91, you're playing with Victor and Martijn, and you're around Scott a lot.
Scott Wyler.
Way later than that.
It's 95,
93?
96. 97, 98. Okay. What years?
Yeah.
That's when I first met you. So
did you use with Scott, too?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I relapsed him after 5 years, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
But Bob did, too.
Yeah,
Bob is, it's the strangest thing working with Bob, because we'll be working with somebody for
years. Not as much as I did with other people, because Scott was a tightwad, and he didn't like sharing, and he wasn't much. Yeah. He'd always say he didn't have any. I'd go to that studio in the Valley and be like, dude, I'm really sick.
Really? He must not like you, because he hooked me up.
Oh.
So we'll be working with somebody for 2 years. We'll be working with somebody.
I was just willing to do certain things, Bob.
But that guy Doug was always around.
Doug,
too.
Yeah, I love Doug.
He didn't want me around.
Is Doug still alive?
Yeah, Doug's still alive. Yeah, he.
No, he was sober through all that.
He relapsed, actually.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah, yeah.
After Scott died, or no?
No, during, I think. Scott has that effect on you.
So Bob and I can be working on something for 2 years, and all of a sudden he'll go, oh, yeah, that guy used to 12-step me, or that guy used to run with back in the – I'm like, why did you tell me that? We worked with the guy for 2 years.
I was a drug addict in the heart of Hollywood from 83 to 95.
And what that taught me was you guys all ran together all the time.
We all know each other in treatment
and out of treatment.
Here's the interesting thing. Whenever I see documentaries about the 80s LA, it's all wrong. Like all the heavy metal people and the punk rockers, we were all hanging out together. Anybody who was a drug addict was hanging out together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Robin Crosby from Rat was
one of my main running
buddies.
River Phoenix.
I wasn't there. I was Halloween night, and it's the time when I was with Shannon Doherty, funny enough. That's a whole other story. And then I...
Okay, did you try to go to the Viper Room one time and she couldn't get in?
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't know.
He wasn't with her when that
happened. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So, she wasn't with him.
I was just so high because I was with her that I don't remember. No, but I remember I drove by and there's this kid on the ground and they were trying to, like,
oh my God,
you know, tell me the word again, Drew.
Resuscitate?
Yes,
resuscitation.
That's the way my brain works, too. Yeah. I'll be calling on you for stuff.
Yeah,
no, for
names. That's all good. It's all good. What's that thing with country states on it? Countries?
Now checks on. Now checks on.
No, and they were trying to bring him back, whatever, and that was River, and I didn't realize. I know. Yeah. I saw that night. Yeah. So crazy.
So that I was using, and then I was sober. So, and then everybody was either sober or using, and I was trying to help them. So there's not,
or they were trying to help you.
A lot of musicians that I didn't.
But I know you agree with this. So I want to ask you what he thinks. Do you think back then when we were drug addicts, right? How it was then, like just the way everything is compared to drug addicts now?
Because he works in treatment now, so he's a little thrown by the new version of drug addicts.
So go ahead, ask a question.
Do you believe it's different?
Oh, it's very different.
Okay, yeah.
It's different for a number of reasons. There are the biggest difference. Well, one of the big differences is that there are people that are now addicted to pills and opiates that would never have been addicts.
Yeah.
They may have been alcoholics, some of them, but most of them certainly never addicts were it not for the medical system bringing this on. Mm-hmm. So that's one population. The other issue is the younger addicts are not like you guys were when you were young addicts.
They weren't selling their stepdad's autographs at 8 years old.
Right.
They
right.
can't even figure out to do that now.
Right. You guys had a
hustle.
You were antisocial. Right. You had an antisocial thing. And it was a rebellion and all that stuff. Mm. Now it's a capitulation or something. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to describe it yet. I can't figure it out. It's a deadening of sorts.
And it feels like it's through society, right? And social media. Yeah. The way it's like everything's so deadened. And you watch everybody and they're just like this.
Yeah.
And it's like we represent these demigods, or we look up to these demigods or ourselves, since nobody – it just seems like there's no connection anymore.
There's no connection. You know? And that's – so early on we were talking about addiction being initiated by an attachment problem. I'm not even sure. This is a different kind of attachment issue. We talk about our early attachment problems.
Non-attachment, disconnected.
It's a disconnect. It's like a willful disconnect or something.
But let me add this. When last episode, or we were talking about
today,
who are gods of junkiedom, right? William Burroughs, Keith Richards, right? There's reasons why those people are. One of the most interesting avant-garde writers of all time, William Burroughs. One of the greatest songwriters who's ever lived in Keith Richards. They were celebrated, and they were junkies, and there was some pull, gravitational pull, to what artists they were. There is no artistry to Ariana Grande.
Okay,
Jennifer Lopez.
Well,
there is no artistry that you're pulling towards. So the idolatry of those types of icons means nothing.
Well,
there's no substance.
You're passing judgment on cultural values, right? How dare you? First of all, I'm outraged. secondly, you're right that there was a culture around drugs that was a very specific culture. We used to, before you got to working with me, we used to think about creating a separate heroin track, so we were creating a different culture for them to feel comfortable, because our heroin recovery.
And then I just brought it by becoming the counselor.
Yeah, well, we had some pretty hardcore heroin addict recovery staff at the time who were advocating for this, and we were sort of trying to figure out how to do it. We just never did it.
But they were poly-substance.
But I liked how it was done too back then. Like
they
even Timmons and all that. Like the way it was done, it was so different back in the day. Just as far
it was direct and honest, correct. And communal.
And
right?
Now you can't say anything to anybody because insurance companies this that. You can't be like, well, there's a fucking door.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just cussed.
Well, that's
Drew's favorite term. Well, that's why we went bankrupt.
It's one of my favorite therapeutic interventions, which is
and our census would be like 8. And I would be like, Drew, you know, come on now. We got to figure out something else to say.
Because there's so many options now. You can be like, okay, later.
Because at Los Encinas, you ever there as a patient?
I visited tons of people.
Okay.
There.
So they would act crazy, or they'd want benzos, and they knew that Drew would send them up to the front where they could get prescription drugs, right? Mm. And and that was your thing. Okay, well, then we're going to transfer you. Bye.
Goodbye.
And I'd be like, now we got nobody. We're going to have to float our second.
Well, I wasn't so such a hatchet man with that. But when somebody was playing cat and mouse and hiding crack pipes out over the wall and stuff like that, it's goodbye.
Yeah, I know a
goodbye.
Few of those people.
That's it. That's it.
And what do you think? I'm sure you guys talked about this a gazillion times and don't really want to bring it up, but I'm just curious to hear your view on the whole buprenorphine maintenance thing.
So, it's fine for the right people.
Well, here's our base, and I think I'm going to speak on your behalf. You tell me if I misspeak. We were originally very concerned because both of us got into this field to create recovery, and our sense of recovery was a fully flourishing, mentally healthy individual who was engaged in life fully and being of service and blossoming in the way that we saw so many of our patients blossom. That's what interested us. That's what we wanted people to share. That's what we wanted to bring people to, right? And we saw lots of it. We never thought, oh, this is never going to happen for anybody. It happened all the time. And we never, ever had any trouble detoxing anybody ever. It wasn't as though I was sitting there going, Jesus, how are we going to get these heroin off? I have heroin. I can't get them off heroin.
Yeah.
Never had a problem with any.
5 days.
5 days
fine.
Off, done, no problem.
Well, I didn't come there.
Yeah, but
I knew like month. You know,
but month. Actually, we were pretty good at it. We were pretty good at making it comfortable.
I mean, Saints, baby! Okay.
But be that as it may. So when buprenorphine came along.
There's actually no game on it. You okay? Sorry.
Oh, my God.
I don't know what
So then buprenorphine came around, and they were trying to pressure me to use it as a detox med. The reason I didn't is having an opiate or a benzodiazepine on the unit made it impossible to run the unit.
Because everybody wants it then.
Because everyone's spinning about getting the drug. And our nursing station was integrated into the treatment unit, remember, if you ever visited there. And so I was like, no, I'm sorry. I can't run the unit like that. So I'm just going to make a decision that we're going to have a certain philosophy of care, a certain way of doing care. Now we're many, many years later, and people are saying it's malpractice if you don't put people on replacement therapy. The risks of a death are too high. We didn't have people die very often until doctors started putting people back on opiates. Our heroin addicts did that. Our alcoholics died more than our heroin addicts, if you remember.
So you didn't do benzos either?
No benzos.
No, like
well, we
taper?
Use them for, we'd use for alcoholics. Yeah. We'd use Librium. Yeah. But
what about for opiates?
No.
What would you use?
Phenobarb.
Oh, yeah, Phenobarb, of course. Yeah. That's the old time. Some clonidine, Robaxin. Yeah. Good old chlorohydrate when we could get that stuff. Good night.
Like green pills.
Yeah. But I'd use a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'd use a ton of it, and
we'd
it would
have
work.
We'd have people like – there was a term there, like – they'd be complaining. Like, if you were there as a client, you would have been complaining.
For sure, guys. And, let's get that straight right now.
And one of us would have just said to the nurse, which is Sasha, put him to sleep for a while.
Yeah. We would.
I could
could do that for you.
Because your blood pressure, we'll take you down. 80 over 50, is that when you go to sleep?
Totally.
That'll be all right. And the doctors nowadays, and I think rightfully so, the quality of care is so poor. It's just not that great.
It's all over the place.
You lower people's blood pressure to that, they're going to die.
But
I'm telling you, they're going to smuggle drugs in. They're going to something bad's going to happen. Somebody's not going to do their check. That's why people are hesitant to detox opiates the way that you were.
So my question is then like now they're putting? I think to use buprenorphine as a taper to detox.
Sure,
great,
no problem.
But now you put people on maintenance. Well, now we're looking at a half-life that's so long. Why not put them on methadone at this point?
Why not put them on heroin?
Why not put them on heroin maintenance? Oh, yeah. They do that. I was in heroin maintenance in England when I lived over there.
Why not?
And it ended up horribly.
You know? but to be fair, the reason why not.
But it wasn't a 21-day taper.
No, it was a 6-month taper, but the taper was upwards.
And to be fair to buprenorphine, it is a different chemical, and it's a mu agonist, and it's got partial. Yeah, all this stuff. And so it actually is different in terms of how its biology works. And so it is safer, and it is gearing more towards the probability of being able to tape you off. It does correct some of the behavior and the thinking and stuff, but you're going to have to be uncomfortable. Doctors don't know how to let people be uncomfortable. They go, oh, you're having withdrawal symptoms? Oh, no, you're craving? Oh, no, we can't. Oh, no. Yeah. Craving? Oh, my God. Cravings, I always look for cravings in my patients. I want them to crave because that's your disease telling you it's okay. Yeah. Now, if you're overwhelmed by cravings, I will help you. But if it's just some cravings and thinking and preoccupation, get in the meeting. Get in there and talk about it. And so, you know, so the point is it upended everything we were doing. And so it sort of concerned us. I you know, we have so many homeless with no resources, disasters out there. Yes, buprenorphine could save lives that way. But if you actually came in and wanted treatment, I'd be like, I don't know. I buprenorphine maybe for a while, but soon off, man.
Okay, so this is what I want to say is my experience for me is that
but you're working in a place. Well, it's outpatient, right?
No. It's inpatient.
Oh, you have inpatient.
And outpatient, and outpatient yeah. has a whole other set of problems associated with it. But go ahead.
But no, I was just saying, so my thing was, they said to me at a certain point, listen, you're a chronic relapser. It's time for you to go on maintenance. You have all this stuff in your life. I was like, great. You know, it sounds great. Now, in the beginning, it was great. I felt great. Like, I had energy. I go, this is sobriety.
Was it methadone or
I'm
buprenorphine?
No, it's buprenorphine. I've done methadone, too. But then it stopped working. I stopped getting the euphoria. I started getting really depressed. Mm-hmm. Now I was just taking it to not get sick. Like, I don't use drugs.
How much were you taking?
To not get sick. I don't remember. 8 milligrams.
Eight twice a day, something
yeah,
like that. Yeah, which is a modest dose. It's not a low dose.
But it stopped working.
And did somebody try to increase you?
I don't even
put you at 16 twice a day. Or something?
Yeah,
no, but people report this depression a lot, especially real drug addicts.
I was unmotivated to do anything except sit there and watch TV and not go out. Whatever, how it affects the brain, you know.
But you got to understand that there are lots of people in my field who would say that's a treatment success.
Yeah, not for me.
Not for me either.
Here's the issue. I need to be able to connect with this man right here and know I'm the same way he is, and we have no fucking secrets, and we're the same. That's how I recover, you know. And if I live the secret,
And I would argue that's the magical realm of spirituality, which is that space that you two create together, and that's where brains heal. Brains heal one another, and especially from horrible spiritual maladies like addiction. Otherwise, you're doing a half measure, and you're sort of making somebody chronically ill. Yeah. And maybe that's the best you can do in some cases. I would hate to see that for you.
And it's just not good for me. I've tried it, you know. I know I'm living a lie, and that's the worst part. It kills me inside. And then I'm just like, well, I might as well go shoot dope, you know. So I'm not saying that doesn't work for everybody. I'm just saying that's my experience because I work in a treatment center where there are people on that medication, and that's fine, you know, for them.
You have to be careful not to judge, right? And maybe weren't there when they originally got on stuff. You don't know how bad they were and stuff. But here's how I would articulate it. I am profoundly concerned by the excessive enthusiasm for this stuff.
Correct.
Well, but let me be devil's advocate. So
you got some in your pocket?
No, here's the thing.
That's Nick Redfield.
20-year-olds, when we were 20, if there was the dope on the street of how we use when we were 20, we'd be dead. We wouldn't be doing a podcast today. I'd be dead of a fentanyl overdose.
Yes, you would.
For sure.
Yeah.
So would you.
But that's another issue.
So they're up against something that I would rather have them on Suboxone and outpatient just until we can figure out this fentanyl thing. Yeah. This fentanyl thing, I think they're making headway about it.
They are.
But there was a huge death last weekend. Like, were 12 people OD'd in one neighborhood
one
or
room,
something?
One room.
I actually shot
that
a lot of fentanyl.
Never helped. You shot fentanyl?
Well, I would get it from a doctor. So liquid, 10 mils.
Why would he give it to you?
Because I had a doctor like that. I get 10 mils of that.
Can we send
you
it to the state?
10 mil dilaudid, you know, all liquid, 10 mil
And that guy
Demerol,
was thinking harm reduction.
10 mil.
He was trying to keep him alive.
Did he give a shit?
No, they didn't give a shit. He's giving the money. They put it in a little brown paper bag, syringes.
Oh, Dr. Mark?
So you could travel.
Dr. Howard Mark?
He's not working anymore. I can tell you that.
He's dead, Howard Mark.
No, it's not Howard Mark. Do you remember Dixon?
Yes.
Was this guy a dermatologist?
No.
Okay.
Oh, he's going after Michael Jackson's guy.
Yeah. Arnie Klein? Yeah. No.
Did you get drugs from him?
No.
Dude, wait till Ashley's book comes out because we talked a little bit about it. I've been trying to help him.
Let's talk
about
that.
You just gotta lay it all on the line and go to Italy for 6 months. Well, that's all you got
to
do.
Listen, the defense
Little
is true.
Italy or- Yeah, I can't afford to go to Italy, boss.
Lower East Side.
You're going to sell this book because if you tell the truth of what you've experienced. I mean, tell this story about ODing in the hospital, in the intensive care thing that you told me at my house.
Were you in intensive care?
And you had...
Hey, let me ask this though. Your feelings of worthlessness and all that stuff flying around. Is that still intense? That's still flying around?
So here's what's so funny with that. Going doing my KDAC and working in recovery. Now, I believe what they say. I believe that you have to be careful because statistically you can go up and I see it get to people's heads where they're not like, you know, because it's still a client thing, right? So I work my recovery program still hard.
And get an Al-Anon program going.
Yeah, Al-Anon too. Yeah. Very hard. But what it does is it keeps me grounded because this addiction doctor told me once, and it wasn't Dr. Drew, he told me that, let's see, he used to deliver kids. And he goes, like, the most painful thing in the world is childbirth. Yeah. You know, screaming, they break their hips, you know, poop all over themselves, whatever, just screaming. 5 months later, they're back pregnant. And he goes, because the human mind forgets. Right. The human mind forgets pain at that level.
That's right.
And so...
It's called state-dependent learning. When you go back into it, you're like, what was I thinking?
Yes.
Pitocin? Yeah.
oxytocin?
No. This is state dependent learning where your brain, nature is good to you when it comes to misery and pain. It makes you forget it.
Yeah, I know. That's why almost had babies again. I know. And then I saw him crying. I had triplets.
Oh, wow.
when they were 2 years old, we went, oh, they're so great. We should do it again. Then we looked at each other. What the fuck?
No, they were like a year old. They were a year? 6 months. They were all so cute for like 10 minutes. And then they started crying.
How long have you guys been together?
When we got pregnant?
Well, I don't know.
All together.
that's another show.
We got married since 91.
Wow.
And okay. Together since like 84.
But we were together 7 years before
that's
that.
That's amazing.
And then I had triplets.
You guys look so great, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Alive and well.
He preserved me.
yeah. I'm not giving compliments because there's something to be had here. You guys generally really look, too.
Thank you.
You look great, both of you.
Thank you.
Bob will talk
and
later.
They have fun.
but I want to get back to the worthlessness.
Yes, but you do forget.
Diversion from
it was. You got me. It's making me nervous. I'm stuttering again.
Because I'll tell you
what's coming back.
No, I'll tell you he reminds me of Mike Catherwood a lot, right? Yeah. Who is this, you know, super good looking guy, and he's got everything in his life, and he just feels like shit all the time, and sometimes I think some of that
the car made him feel good for a while.
He has things he can do.
If I had a cologne, it would be Insecurity by Ashley Hamilton. How's my hair look? Do I look okay? Do my arms?
But it's sometimes I think it's the drugs. They do something to the developing brain, and that may add to some of that feeling of chronic depression or something, and then that worthlessness drips in with that. Is that what you experience?
Yeah, I would say that's probably correct. You know,
are you working on that? Are you looking at that? Because I mean, after you've been sober about a year, it becomes important to look at that stuff because that's what I call full recovery, which is when you're like, okay, now I've got my recovery, it's going well, and now I got to start looking at. And it's very treacherous as you look at these other things.
What about antidepressants? You ever been on antidepressants?
I have, but I didn't really find.
Were you using?
Work?
No. No, I stopped him 3 days ago. I feel great.
Oh, well,
there you go. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
A little Lexapro withdrawal.
No, and I think they're good and they have a place. I feel fine without them. I've been without them for like 4 months.
Okay. You know? So watch out for it. That's all I'm saying.
I feel like it's more cognitive thinking.
So you can correct it with some self-talk.
TM's helped a lot. I've done a lot of therapy, but like now I'm very aware of it. And also, you know, I stayed out of work this last year just because I felt like that's such a weird place. There's so much drugs, environment. There's so much, okay, how are we doing? Just the validation. I've stayed away.
Good.
I just worked in treatment, and I feel good on a daily basis.
You mentioned Robert Downey Jr. a few minutes ago. Yeah. I think it was how many times he'd been treated. The reason he got sober is he just said, I'm not working, and I'm not thinking about going back to work ever, maybe. He asked me once if he should ever return to work. I was like, Jesus, I don't know. I can't say that.
I would say that, but as soon as something came along, I'd be like, okay, yeah. And now this year I haven't. I've turned stuff down.
Right.
Everything.
That's really, really particularly for that first year. I think the reason we had, you know, when you think about people who have performing lives relapsing frequently, it's because they go back too fast.
100%. And I also feel like I've had years multiple times. You know, I've had years multiple times, but that worthlessness and not feeling good enough and depression.
Get that treated. Think of that as a symptom.
How do you get that treated? I've sat in talk therapy for my whole life.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like it's really done anything.
Well, what if it was an injury from the drugs, you know, some brain chemical thing, and you have to, like, find somebody to help you correct that?
There's also theories.
Dr. Drew volunteering here,
volunteering.
Ashley.
I
hear him volunteering.
After a week, you tap out. He's like, Bob, you take him, bro.
I'm out.
No, but
he's all into weird stuff now.
Okay,
the bergamot and all that kind of stuff and nutrition. Supplements.
I believe in all that too. So check this out. I had a subdural hematoma. Trauma. So a pituitary gland was knocked too. And they just did a test in the last 6 months where I had no ADH, right?
And
zero. I was always pissing, drinking.
Oh my God.
And as you know, it affects the pituitary, which also affects serotonin, dopamine.
Also, your sodium is all whacked out.
I was eating chicken, salty chicken.
I couldn't stop.
And this professor from Harvard was the one to say, test for this. I didn't test low for ADH, I had zero. Zero. So now I take the spray. I forget what it's called.
DDAVP.
That's it. DDA. Mm-hmm. So I take that 3 times a day.
What is that?
it's ADH. It's a snifter. Yeah. It's this ADH stuff. But that should tell you. Yeah. And that might, you know, that should tell you that your brain is like needs some support, needs some help.
And no, and I feel better. And they said like within like it takes a couple months to really adjust and start working. You know? And I really feel a huge difference in
I'm
that.
Sure.
Just like cognitive and everything. And
maybe there are other hormones too that are out. I mean, did they look at everything else?
They're going to take a look again too to see.
Yeah, good.
But here's, I want to ask you this question too. So I am on HRT, and I've seen you. I remember when you were doing the show, you were like totally against people who were doing steroids.
I'm in favor of HRT. I wish I could take HRT. I'd love to take
Why
HRT.
Can't you?
I have prostate cancer.
Okay.
And hormone replacement therapy. I would love to. Yeah.
I take it.
Yeah, she takes it.
Yeah, for estrogen, though.
No, and testosterone.
Oh, really?
Testosterone.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I would,
that's why my voice
really,
is so low. I used to be a soprano.
Wait, what are you guys into here?
No, I'm telling you, you want to get hippie. Yeah. This guy's a hippie.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm just open to ideas. And I keep fantasizing about growth hormone because people have a lot of good stuff from that. And I would love to take a little testosterone. In fact, when I had my prostate taken out, it was seven years ago. I sat down with the guy. I go, in 5 years, you're going to put me on testosterone. That's my payoff for all this. I'm going to go through. Still not.
So did you ever take HRT?
No.
Okay. Well, how are your arms so jacked?
This is just genetics.
What level is your testosterone?
It fluctuates a bunch, between 400 and 800.
See, I'm
on this sort of keto carnivore diet. Yeah. It's up with that.
But see, there's so many different theories on meat, too, which is so like back and forth.
I can tell you mine's up on the meat.
Okay.
It's up.
Okay.
Why does it have it? See, it doesn't have to be Lexapro or antidepressants or whatever. It can be this stuff. That's all I'm saying.
Well, what I'm thinking.
Well,
let me tell you
something about hormones, though. If I was on antidepressants when I, you know, for a period of time, and it was because I was going through menopause and didn't know it. If I had gone on testosterone and hormone replacement, I would have felt much better and would have been able to avoid that.
Yeah.
So I spent like 5 years in misery. And then finally, one day, they told me about bioidenticals, and now I'm a lot happier.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean,
are you doing bioidenticals?
Yes, he has to. The professor from Harvard said everything's hormones.
Yeah.
He goes, everything's hormones.
Well, so if you're a hammer, the whole world's a nail. That's what I would say.
It's a beautiful thing.
But just as far as getting that just to a certain place, whatever.
Yeah.
And I agree. So they started me on 12% bioidentical testosterone cream, and it only got me up to 370. Right, because I was low. I was like 150 or something.
So wow, that's low.
That's all.
Yeah. But do you do pellets? You can get the pellets too. And
he's doing the cream.
Which but is you fine. Can't tell how much you're taking. You know, it's really
four
hard.
Clicks.
Yeah, let him. No. Let him. That's,
if it works, it works.
Please, Dr. Pinsky. let him follow.
Hey, man,
the Harvard endocrinologist recommendation.
If you IV it, it's gonna.
No, they put it. They put what they do is.
I know what they do. I know what he's doing.
We're drifting into it.
We're drifting into it.
I cause fights wherever I go. Can we stand
up, Bob? Keep going everywhere you go.
It's a miracle that I'm such a happy person now.
It's
like
a miracle.
I was.
It's
so
he's agreeing. Yes,
he's like more hormones, whatever. Yeah, pellets. Go for it. Double the pellets.
He loves it.
Here, can I just say an environmental thing? Simultaneous to your happiness is an empty nest. Also, might I?
Well, I also
well,
can
one's
have
bounced
sex
back
every day.
Oh, yeah. One's bounced
sex
back.
Regular, one's bounced back.
Oh, okay.
I got.
Yeah,
so I got,
now that one's in the house, we don't.
You
do
never
it as much,
lived at your parents after you were like 18, did you?
I did when I got sober at 20 because I only had one arm. This arm didn't work. And a leg, so no sober livings would take me because I was a liability.
Wow.
What was wrong with that arm?
I overdosed for 5 days on the left side and all the
nerves
died.
You crushed it.
Yeah, dead.
I mean, how did you get it back?
I couldn't even. They said it was never coming back.
It grew back?
A thumb didn't come, nothing. I mean, I had to have it in a sling because it just fell down. Nothing would move and atrophied the whole thing.
Yeah.
One day I was in the car and thumb just went like that by itself. Right. And that was the beginning over a couple of years.
How crazy is that?
I have a question. Before you go, and I'm not saying you have to go, but,
but you
from
don't.
A parent's point of view, from a mother's point of view, if I was your mother and living in the environment that I brought you up in, what would I do differently to help you avoid becoming an addict?
Oh, that's a Facebook. That's like all moms want to know
anything.
That. How do you prevent Ashley Hamilton from happening?
Yeah. I mean, please. Okay, is there anybody got a time machine?
I mean, you weren't. Your father isn't a drug addict. Your mother.
I think the military. I got one idea. I think the military school is a wrong thing.
Let him answer it.
I think it's a wrong thing.
I mean, not. I mean,
that's
you don't
your
have
junkie
to be,
self
but
saying
it
that.
Reinforces abandonment.
I kind of believe in environment being a big factor.
I got two questions for you to come back to. For this. Yes, I'm going to answer that. What I'm going to say is that it's DNA part. I have alcoholism all around my family.
Oh, okay.
My uncle died of cirrhosis of the liver from drinking himself to death.
Yeah.
On your dad's side or your mom's side?
On my dad's side. But my mom's dad was an alcoholic mom. I mean, it's just like Cherokee that got the Indian blood,
okay,
too.
So the Cherokee is a major burden.
Yeah.
That's very heavy.
So it's hereditary.
50%. Right?
All you need is a 0.25% Cherokee. Yeah. That's a heavy hit for addiction. Yeah.
So being in a rock star home with a lot of on the road and being around drugs and alcohol, if you didn't have that, what would have...
The one thing I can say, because it kind of goes back to the question earlier, was I always felt uncomfortable because of the dynamic I grew up in. So as soon as I could escape, I wanted to escape. You know, the problem is you can't escape. There's nowhere you can go that you can escape it. It's not like a small town and let's say your dad's a sheriff and you feel the same way, you have the same feelings, but you want to leave home. It doesn't matter where you go. You know, that's the problem with
everybody knows you.
Yeah, everywhere. And I always hated that, and I always felt like I never got to do I thought I should got with the work I did, because I was always overshadowing, which created more drugs and more resentment. And I feel like, yes, that was a huge factor. I feel like I had childhood, you know, trauma, which was a huge thing.
Right.
Can you talk about
the
what
divorce?
Happened?
The trauma was?
Yeah.
I was molested as a kid. So, in that household. So that, with all that stuff, you know, and then the DNA side.
I always, by the way, felt that's what Scott never got over.
Yeah.
Didn't he have something like that happen?
His was awful.
Yeah, that's what he never, ever, like, ever was even evil willing to talk about, really.
Yeah.
So that trauma is a key thing.
Huge.
But then let's just look at the positive side. You got our mutual friends that we're talking about that were in the same band or sober for decades, transcending their pain and abuse. I would say AK's trauma as a child is the worst I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So mine is pretty bad. Using drugs with your mom, partying with your mom, you know what I mean? Shooting drugs with your dad there's just chaos.
But
we can get sober. Both, I was sexually abused as a kid. There's another side of that. That doesn't give you a death sentence to have to die like Scott.
No, correct.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I just think that Scott never wanted to be right-sized.
And he suffered from mental illness, too, which is never addressed. People kind of overlook that all the time because of who he was. I feel like somehow he got away with a lot of the mental illness side, too. Mary and I always talk about that.
He had eating disorder.
Eating disorder,
which I suffered from as well. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a huge one. That kept taking me out after years of sobriety many times. Like, I could not stop throwing up, bulimia.
Oh,
and I was living like – I always say there's nothing worse than active addiction and recovery, because you're supposed to be rocketed to this fourth dimension. Yeah. Everybody seems so joyous in these programs.
Oh, no,
and you're like, I don't have that, you know, and you can't stop and you feel the same way. And it's
you got introduced into Mike. This is the exact same stuff.
Oh, no.
Mike's got the exact same stuff.
But Mike's all buff now.
But it's not necessarily
what are you
good.
Trying to say, Bob?
Okay, no, if I was a mom and I was a celebrity, and I would put less pressure on my kids to be perfect or be a part of it, or I wouldn't make them a part of it.
I think I saw really young.
And I'd be very overprotective, make sure. You know.
I think I saw really young that to be loved, you had to have these things. My dad was at the top of his game. Rod was at the top of this game. This, to me, equaled love. You know, and I feel like I had to have all the stuff just to be okay.
Yeah.
And I never seemed to achieve that, and I always felt less than and worse about myself.
But at a certain point, when you met your tribe of people... None of us believed that.
But the thing is, that's where we're like, when we did the Wonder Girls record with me and Weiland and all the guys and Martine, as you're saying, like, that's the great thing about addicts. And like I said, I have to be like Bob, is because we all get together and we do are able to share that. Mm-hmm. It's not so burdensome. Yeah, there's lots of other therapy stuff, but there's power in those numbers.
No, there's support on a what, you know, he used to, I remember the psychiatrist's name. He was the guy that he was. can't remember his name, but he said that, you know, addicts commune on a shared level of pain, that you're all yes. together in your yes. shared experiences. Yes. And I'm okay, I've experienced it, I support you, I see you, I know you. Yes. And if you're an addict, you don't necessarily trust that, but if you Correct. Really believe that somebody's walked in your shoes, yeah. it's sort of a weak way of saying it, it connects you, and that's the piece. Humans are better when they're connected. They're just better. We're all better.
We are. And that's the problem with society now, like we were talking about earlier, is that we're separating each other, so 100%. There is no togetherness anymore. 100%. It's just, you know, individuals and that's it. But it's fascinating, all this stuff. But I find that to all be true with what you're saying. I mean, is we need each other. And I also find, like it's what you said as well, Drew, is that I, if you tell me what to do, I'm going to be like, go screw yourself, you know? But if I'm like, well, how did Bob do that? He seems to be doing this. Alcoholics, we have to approach you and go, hey, Bob, how did you do
alcoholics,
this?
Alcoholics respond to people that care about them in one of two ways. You abandon me, or you're trying to control me. Yeah. One or the other. You're the boss of me. You're the boss of me, or you're going to leave me. And it's like there's no in between. It's so
that's so
it's like
true.
So when you're a co, it's like I'm doing neither, man. I'm just here.
It's so true. I need to work on that. I feel like it's so true. I feel
you're
like
doing
every
that's alcohol.
You're doing a lot of the things that I like. You're staying away from Hollywood.
Yeah,
stay
with the winners.
You live in Huntington Beach, correct?
So yes,
Huntington Beach. Oh, Newport. Oh, look at that.
You live in Newport?
I do. No,
that's where she's from.
I love Newport.
Right. I grew up there.
Yeah, I was in Huntington too. I love Huntington. No, Huntington's great. I love Huntington. I got to be careful because they'll beat me up over there.
Yeah. I'm in Laguna now.
But yeah, Laguna's great too.
Yeah, I'm in Laguna.
But
I
was
saying, it's a good place.
But back to your question about raising kids, you raise them in a place where there's just families and schools and like where you're raising your kids. You try to stay out of the whatever.
Yeah, so it's hard. That's such a hard question.
It is hard.
To answer. But I think one thing is really watch your kids. Really watch who's around them.
Yeah. Be paranoid.
Yes, and just be really involved as you can in their lives. Be paranoid, you know, because I think a lot, you know, just being in this town brings in a lot of bad energy around, you know, and it's easy to fall into that, I feel like, you know.
Right.
Have time for
but
people.
But it also does some good.
I learned that at a funeral yesterday. Mm. This old Chinese guy died, and his message was to have time for people.
Yeah.
Have time for your kids. Have time for your family.
And somebody said to me, I was reading something there, like to show people, like it's not about the conversation necessarily. When you stop at work to talk to somebody, it's not, don't judge the meaningless conversation. Judge that you're stopping there to honor this person and be like, I honor you enough to stand here and have this with you.
And I would argue that the piece, I'm going to think a lot more about this the next couple of years, but human bodies, two bodies in space, communicate in ways that we're not aware of that are important. Like us just sitting here, we're all kinds of information's going back and forth. I mean, we look at each other, we look each other in the eyes, we think, we talk, but really there's this some biorhythmic flow or some God knows who knows what going between two people. And when you allow that to happen in space, in closeness, it's healthy. It's healing. It's good.
That's how Gandhi changed everything. Mm-hmm. The frequency, the vibration. We raise it up when we're together in this. And that's like,
which is another thing. Quickly on TM. How
interception.
How is that affecting the team?
It's like a football team. It's like the closeness between a football
team. Yes, yes. Why do all you guys say my team? My team. My team lost us. Because like, these guys don't know who you are. Like, I didn't know you were on the team. You know?
I got the shirt.
Yeah. Totally.
It's actually kind of cool though, because like this is a huge game and it's really fun to watch you guys.
I think
talk and then watch this at the same time. I think we should do it every week.
You guys are gonna teach me the games. You could do that too.
Yeah.
I'll come back.
So, but we don't talk.
TM,
we don't. But we don't talk
resets
about
the brain. That's what it does.
Well, Dan Siegel, if people are interested in meditation, he writes a bunch of books on mindfulness. What's your experience with it?
Okay, so I break it down to this. Bob and I were having a conversation earlier about it today. I believe so. We get to the part of the book in Alcoholics Anonymous where it says God is everything or nothing. Now you can replace that and you can say program is everything or nothing. Right? Program is everything or nothing. Now if it's nothing, I can choose that. That's my choice. But if it's everything, it's also prayer and meditation, right? So it's not like 11 and a half steps. It's everything. And I always left that component out, you know, always left it out. And Bill Wilson talks about in the book many times about meditation and prayer. And I sent Bob, did I send you an article today about that or no? There's an article I read yesterday about Bill Wilson when he finally went to Transcendental Meditation. He said, I finally understood what meditation was really about. And that was like in 1960 or something. But I find that my whole life I've always been – you know, I've always just been like reactive. You know, I haven't been able to respond. Yeah. And I feel like TM has made me able to respond, even though I talk fast and blah, 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 but like my, as far as my feelings go or something I think that you've done or perceived, like I can kind of move back. And there's this oneness where you move with whatever that energy you were just talking about is, you start to feel that energy and you transcend and you quiet down the mind. Now, mm-hmm. I've done mindfulness. I love mindfulness, but there's something about TM just about, you know, transcending
okay.
and being awake and in that, you know, because 11 steps says conscious contact, right? Like, I mean, it's so spiritual and we forget all that stuff, you know? We just hang out meetings. Oh, yeah, I've been through the steps and sponsoring dudes, but we really forget that spiritual part, right? And the word spiritual has the word ritual in it. So it's something I do every day, ritual, you know?
Right.
And you grow by that.
And I would argue that's part, when we talk about full recovery, that's the kind of stuff I think we got to make sure people add in as their primary recovery takes hold.
But it's so hard. You have to be like, desperate for it, and I think it's hokey pokey, you know.
You just gotta, you gotta be willing. Yeah. Bottom line, you gotta be willing.
Yeah,
gentlemen.
It's you call me a gentleman.
I'm so glad you guys found each other. I'm
yeah,
so happy.
Yeah, me
for
too.
That.
Me
yeah.
too.
It's been fun.
Bob's yeah. gonna be my mentor.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just gotta call me back more.
Just tell him all what not to do.
What does he have to do more?
Call me back more. Yeah.
Oh, you gotta text him. Don't leave any messages.
No, I'm kind of the same way. It's a new generation. They call you like they get afraid. Like he's stalking me. You know.
You have to get in line with the Rolling Stones here.
Oh yeah. Oh, Bob got
text.
I've got some text from Keith Richards.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah.
Stepdad's Rod Stewart. Like, that's going to impress him.
That's already down here. I mean, no, that's impressive. That's...
He responds to me because he knows he can make money. But that's
impressive. Yeah, we can make money.
He knows the hell you'll give him if you don't respond.
That's... Yeah, you should come back. Yeah.
I'd love to anytime.
Yeah,
it's great. It's great to hang out.
Beautiful.
I love hanging out in this environment, too, where it's not so corporate. Like, every time I've done something with him, still, it's like, I don't know.
No, this is. Do we just sit and chat?
And watch football.
Yeah.
We're men's men.
It's a weird, different. Why don't we watch this last field goal here?
Yeah, here it goes. Game on the line.
They're gonna ice him. It's gonna be
Rams and the Saints, 23-23, and
timeout.
55-yard
timeout.
Time for a field goal. They
called timeout. Of course, they're gonna ice him.
I'm just glad we got to see it because if we had heard this had happened,
we'd be pissed. All right, thank you, everybody. We'll see all that cashy
thing. Sorry.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Thanks for listening and subscribing on your favorite platforms. Rate us 5 stars and tell a friend. Also, be sure to visit drdrew.com for the latest news. We'll tell you where you can find all of our health-related content, including the latest in-depth series, The History of Opium. You can now listen to it on the weekly Infusion podcast. We have some great and very interesting and appropriate interviews with key historical players in the history of opium. We're excited about our newest podcast, Dr. Drew After Dark, which has been described as a dark web reboot of Loveline. It's the hottest guest spot for all the most popular comedians. Beware, it is for a mature audience. It is kind of a reboot of Loveline. You can hear the episodes first in a podcast form Thursday. Then on Friday, you can watch all the video episodes when the YouTube page drops on the Your Mom's House YouTube channel. New episodes every week. Subscribe, tell a friend. Also on Dr.com, you can find Swole Patrol, our health and fitness podcast with Mike Catherwood. If you want something a bit more refined that will expand your intellectual horizons, please subscribe to the Dr. Drew podcast, where I feature a wide variety of very interesting and important guests. Get in-depth interviews there. Last but not least, me and Adam and Dr. Drew Show podcast. It's a lot of fun, and we are still together, and you can get it 5 days a week. So go to drdrew.com. Please tell a friend, and we thank you for it. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.